Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. This week on the show, DW's Dana Scherler joins me in the studio. She's just back from covering the hotly watched elections in Moldova. Meanwhile, in the last days before Czechia goes to the polls, a familiar pattern has been playing itself out. Then, drone startups, with NATO in urgent need of rapidly scalable, cost-effective solutions to Russian aerial warfare. Might they be able to position themselves as rivals to military industrial giants like Rheinmetall and Lockheed Martin? Those stories and more coming up on the programme. Last Sunday, the tiny landlocked country of Moldova, population around 2.4 million, went to the polls in national elections billed as a choice between Europe or Russia, democracy or autocracy. The international stakes were also high because of fears that, should Moldova fall back under Russian influence, this could open up a new flank in Moscow's war with neighbouring Ukraine. Despite unprecedented levels of Russian-funded election interference, Moldova's decision was clear. President Maia Sandu's pro-EU Party of Action and Solidarity won just over 50% of the votes, and that's compared to just 24.18% for the pro-Russia patriotic bloc. And to talk about it all and what it means, I am joined in the studio by DW's Dana Scherler.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Big sigh of relief. What was it like being there on that night, seeing those results come in, surrounded by, I presume, your team, right? The colleagues that have been reporting on this, living this day in, day out for weeks.
The atmosphere was extremely tense. During the whole weeks up to the elections, everyone was very worried. I mean, we even talked to young colleagues, for example, young freelancers who have small kids and who told me that they were planning to leave the country to grant their children a better future in case the pro-Russians win. Or other colleagues were even afraid that if the pro-Russians win, they might adopt a law similar to that, to the law in Russia regarding foreign agents. And so journalists or other professionals working for international organizations might become foreign agents and really get into trouble in their own country. So a lot was at stake also on the personal level for each one of them. And also for the war in Ukraine, it would have been a catastrophe for the war in Ukraine if the pro-Russians had won in the Republic of Moldova. Because don't forget, in Moldova you have this separatist region, Transnistria, where Russian troops are still stationed illegally. And those troops might have opened a new front from the west, so a front from Transnistria in the direction of Odessa.
Yeah. But I mean, it just, you know, working with political stakes, but also personal and social stakes that are that high, it must be a very intense experience for you as a reporter.
Of course, it is. It is. And it is very important also to show your colleagues' solidarity in such times.
How do you do that?
And, well, also by just being there, by physically being there during these really troubled times.
Yeah, and I just want to say, because, I mean, a lot of international news organizations were sending over people from their main offices to cover the election. But your case, Dana, it's rather different because you have a long-standing relationship with Moldova that you've built up over years now.
Exactly. So we have one correspondent, for example, who has been working for DW Romania for 27 years.
Hmm. How many times have you personally been to Moldova in the past few years?
Oh, so many times. I can't really tell you. I mean, this year I've been there already three times before the elections.
And as a Romanian in Moldova, do you see parallels. And I'm thinking back, of course, to last year, because last year it was the Romanian presidential elections that everybody was watching, because there we had a situation where a far-right pro-Moscow candidate came out of nowhere. It wasn't actually nowhere. It was TikTok. People talked about the TikTok election because of sort of dark money. And the whole thing was absolutely thrown into upheaval. And Romania is still trying to deal with the consequences even now.
Yes, there are parallels. I think the Moldovan authorities did a much better job at actually explaining people about Russia's hybrid war, about explaining what happened, explaining exactly and delivering proof. Also, the police and the security forces did a very good job when it came to dismantling these structures.
Okay, and which included in the very, very last days of the election, the banning of two much smaller parties. Can you tell me about that? Because that's it. That for Moscow, that is a key sort of part of their claim that the elections were not fair. So I'd like to ask you about that, and I'd also like to ask you whether, from your perspective there on the ground, you encountered the elections as fair.
Yes, of course, these elections were fair, and this is not only what journalists are saying, this is what international observers are also saying. And banning parties before the elections was not something undemocratic, because it was a party that actually had received illegal funding. So if you don't respect the rules of a game, it is okay to be banned from this game. Mm-hmm. It's just normal. If you don't play by the rules, it's normal to be excluded from a game. It's just like in sports, in the Olympics.
So it sounds as though Moldova has a lot to teach the rest of Europe right now about how to counter Russian attempts to interfere in European democracies. I wanted to talk to you about Europe. So Moldova's had candidate status since 2022, and this election was very much about Europe. What does Moldova's path look like right now as it attempts to go from candidate to member state?
Well, of course, this path is always long and it's sometimes a bumpy road. But I think especially in this case, it's very important that the European Union delivers and stays true to its promises, because otherwise, of course, Moldovans would be very disappointed. But at the same time, I would say it was not only a pro-European vote, it was also, and this is very important, it was a vote against Russia. They were afraid of their country becoming some sort of a gray zone again, dominated by Russia. So I think this is almost even more important, that it was a vote against Russia and against Russia's hybrid war. And I think this can be a lesson for all of Europe, that the hybrid war can be countered and you can, as a democracy, you can still win.
Dana Scherle, DW Head of Romanian Service, thank you so much for coming into the studio.
Thank you.
No sooner has the dust settled on the Moldovan elections than it is Czechia's turn. Czech voters head to the ballot box this week amid, you guessed it, concerns over Kremlin interference. Surveys suggest the present pro-Western, pro-Kiev government bloc could be swept aside. But by whom? Populist tycoon Andrej Babiš is leading the race for a comeback to the premiership, though he will almost certainly require partners from the fringes of Czech politics. And their demands will not come cheap. Rob Cameron reports from Prague.
The final TV debate ahead of this weekend's crunch parliamentary elections, as well as the first and only head-to-head clash between the current Prime Minister, Petr Fiala, and the man vying to replace him, former Premier Andrej Babiš.
Bývalý premiér České republiky. Dobrý večer, pane předsedo.
The two men have very different visions for the Czech Republic, Mr. Fiala says now is not the time to change course, and especially not the time to ease up on the country's firm support for Ukraine's war effort or start spending less on defence. Mr. Babiš says the current government is whipping up fear and panic among Czechs with its talk of the looming threat of war with Russia. Instead, he promises a return to financial prosperity, less on defence, more on pensions and housing for young families. He also says he's tired of hearing the same old allegations against him, that he was an informant for the communist-era secret police, that he embezzled EU funds meant for small businesses when his was anything but. This supporter at one of his recent election rallies believes him 100%.
I think he's so rich that he has no need to steal. Now they're saying again that he has to pay back some EU subsidies. But it's not like he personally showed up and said, "My name is Babiš, I'm here for the subsidies." It's his holding company that got them. And he already paid the money back, yet they keep going after him for it. From what I heard, they even said all the money had been donated to charity. So, as far as I'm concerned, the whole thing is settled.
The latest accusation levelled against him is that he'll start cozying up to the Kremlin, following in the footsteps of Viktor Orban in Hungary and Robert Fico in Slovakia. Again, those claims fell on deaf ears here at this rally for his Ano party.
It's nonsense. They'll make some kind of deal. I don't think we'll leave the EU. And all that talk about dragging the country to the east, it's just rubbish. I don't believe it. It's total nonsense. I get that you have to negotiate with everyone, whether it's China or Russia or whoever, but the idea that our country would actually turn toward the east is just ridiculous.
Those two Babiš supporters were in their 70s, but many younger voters too are unhappy, especially with the cost of living. But not all of them are flocking to Andrej Babiš or the openly Eurosceptic far-right or far-left extremists. Andrej Kapralek is a 19-year-old activist for the Liberal Pirate Party, and he's about to vote for the first time.
The living conditions from this perspective are starting to be like unbearable for my generation. So I do want Czechia to be a country where young people can like start families and live here and stay here and see future here. But when I want this country to offer a good future for young people, that of course means that I feel like we should be a strong part of the European Union.
Andrej Babiš has repeatedly ruled out a referendum on leaving the EU or NATO, even if he is forced to seek the support of extremist parties to form a government. But the problem, and it could soon be a problem for the country's Western partners too, is that those parties are demanding other things too: an end to the successful Czech ammunition initiative for Ukraine, an end to measures against Russian disinformation. Some want the expulsion of Ukrainian refugees. Political scientist Petr Just says there's little doubt Andrej Babiš will come first in this election, but he'll be watching the results of these smaller extremist parties with great trepidation.
In my opinion, Andrej Babiš has a lot to worry about, not about the result of ANO. It's pretty much, if nothing serious happens in the last few days and hours before the elections, he is on the run to become the winner of the next elections. But it will very likely be a Pyrrhic victory, because this victory also needs to be transformed into ruling, into coalition, some coalition architecture. And he will be either directly or indirectly dependent on other political forces to give him votes for the majority which is needed to maintain a stable government. And Andrej Babiš will probably very nervously watch during the election night, not only as the results will be coming for ANO, but also results that would be coming for the two or three other political movements and forces which might be potentially his coalition partners.
Andrej Babiš a Petr Fiala.
A lot can still happen, of course, and it's still possible the parties of the current centre-right coalition, together with the pirates, will reach the magic threshold of 101 seats in the 200-seat lower house. But frankly, it's unlikely. and the Czech Republic, which up until now has been one of the staunchest allies of Ukraine, could be on the brink of changing course. For DW, this is Rob Cameron in Prague.
Results in those elections are expected to be coming in on Saturday evening. So if you are listening to us over the weekend, you can follow DW News for the latest. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. On Wednesday, French military personnel boarded an oil tanker suspected of being a launch pad for mystery drone flights that forced the closure of airports in Denmark last week. The ship's captain and his first mate were taken into custody. It's just the latest in a series of events that have kept the threat of drone warfare at the forefront of European consciousness. At the recent Estonian Defence Week in Tallinn last month, Ben Bakker's attention was caught by the pitches of defence startups positioning themselves to offer agile, scalable solutions quicker and more cheaply than the more established military-industrial big players.
Lithuania-based Harlequin Defense is one of dozens of defense startups that showcased their military solutions at the first Estonian Defense Week in Tallinn last month.
We will have a fully MVP version by the end of October.
And they're actively seeking investment, so come find us.
Ritis Mikalauskas and his small team have developed a thermal camera that rotates 360 degrees and can detect drones from up to 300 meters away.
It has attachments for rocket or any other interceptor launchers on both sides. So it can launch net, it can use laser, it can use some rockets.
Albeit still at the prototype stage, Mikalauskas hopes for his solution to not only help Ukraine fend off Russia, but also one day be tapped by Western militaries to help plug NATO's lack of cost-effective countermeasures to deal with cheap Russian drone attacks.
Often our radars don't see them because they fly too low, they're made of the materials that you don't have a good radar signature.
That's Tomas Gemalauchus, a researcher with Tallinn's International Center for Defense and Security. He thinks agile startups have the potential to disrupt sluggish procurement systems and help the alliance keep up with the changing nature of contemporary warfare.
If the means are very expensive, like we saw with the Polish incident, the missiles that fire from the F-16s or F-35s, you know, they cost up to $500,000 against a drone, which is, what, 10, 20,000, maximum 50,000. It's not a very economical use of force.
In a full-scale war, military experts worry that this kind of unsustainable cost-benefit balance could become a serious problem for NATO's air defenses. That's because Russia could swiftly exhaust the Allies' limited reserves of highly expensive interceptors with waves of cheap drones.
My name is Kusti Salm. I am the CEO of Frankenburg Technologies.
Salm was the chief civil servant in the Estonian Defense Ministry until he quit a little over a year ago, citing what he considered to be a lack of investment on the part of the Estonian government to prepare for a Russian assault. Together with Estonia's former top general, a leading rocket scientist and one of Estonia's richest businessmen, Salm built an air defense platform prototype in less than a year that he says has so far undergone more than 50 live fire tests. According to Salm, Frankenburg already has one NATO country as a customer and will soon be producing hundreds of interceptor missiles per week, with the aim of making them 10 times cheaper than existing short-range air defense interceptors like Sidewinders, or 100 times cheaper than the $4 million cost of a single Patriot missile.
Everything that Russia launches at Ukraine and would potentially launch at European targets is by an order of magnitude cheaper than anything that we take them down with.
While Western militaries have an apparent interest in cost-effective solutions like Frankenburg's, there seems to be a degree of caution among traditionally rather risk-averse militaries to invest in largely unproven technologies, especially when it comes to drone interception. At the same time, there is an increasing frustration with the so-called primes, large defense companies like Airbus, Rheinmetall or Lockheed Martin, whose expensive high-end capabilities depend upon lengthy production cycles. In view of the rapidly changing nature of aerial threats, many in the defense community are arguing for a pivot towards cheaper and more scalable options. One initiative to defend against the potential types of onslaughts Moscow is now able to muster is an anti-drone defense system along NATO's eastern flank, dubbed the Drone Wall. Long requested by the Baltic nations and Poland, the network of radars, acoustic sensors, mobile cameras, jammers, and drone interceptors was ultimately backed by EU chief von der Leyen on September 10, just hours after Poland scrambled fighter jets to shoot down drones over its territory. One of the initiators of the drone wall idea, which might one day stretch from northeastern Norway to Bulgaria's Black Sea coast, is 7-year-old Estonian company DefSec Intel. CEO Janus Tamm says the idea is to create a multi-layered, interoperable mesh of new tech and conventional air defense systems like Patriots or anti-aircraft tanks.
The aim is to equip acoustic sensors to detect flying things based on engine sound, then deploy different mobile, relocatable or stationary platforms for detecting and tracking aerial targets, but also ground targets or something which are on the river or the sea.
Although the timeline, exact tactical details and the funding for the drone wall remain unclear for now, the new European Defense Industry Program, EDIP, could help secure its future long term. One of the big question marks is whether Europe can replicate Ukraine's capabilities without being under the same level of threat, although Ukrainian President Zelensky on Monday proposed building a joint air defense shield. Other concerns about the effectiveness of the drone wall include long command chains, slow and bureaucratic military procurement, as well as the need to integrate thousands of sensors and other technology into a complex system. Here's researcher Tomas Dzemalauchos again.
At the moment, we have probably at least 3 drone wall concepts evolving parallelly. If those concepts are incompatible, they are not kind of integrated into a coherent whole, starting with the sensorics, ending with the shooters, and in between all the, you know, necessary training, all the information exchange, communication, common operational pictures, and so on, then it's going to be a mess.
Dzemalauchos is also concerned about NATO military's capacity for improvisation and adaptability. Some advanced Ukrainian brigades are said to have dozens of software engineers and coders who do nothing but analyze live intelligence or change the software of drones to ensure they remain effective amid electronic warfare. That's why Ukraine's expertise in drone production is seen as key for Europe's plans to scale up drone defense systems. Many Western startups and established businesses by now have direct links to Ukrainian frontline units, allowing them to respond more quickly and accurately to the constantly changing battlefield. But Denis, a Ukrainian drone expert whose organization teaches people to build and send low-cost drones to Ukrainian military units, doesn't think that's enough.
Having spoken to militaries of other countries, I see how little they know about the current state of warfare with drones. They have to take a look at all of the types of the drones that are used on the front line and think about a countermeasure for each one of them, which one would be the most cost-effective. We want Russia to be contained and not be able to make any move.
Ben Bartke, DW in Tallinn, Estonia.
Just a quick announcement. Inside Europe's Grief, a Catalyst for Social Change special is a finalist in this year's Signal Podcast Awards. But now comes the voting stage. So if you want to support us or our journalism, please do consider voting for us. You will find a link in the show notes. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. Coming up in the next half hour, we journey into the dark heart of Europe's recycling industry and try to understand why Croatia's Prime Minister suddenly seems comfortable with fascist-era salutes at music concerts. But before we get into all that, let's take 5 minutes to get to grips with the case of one Nicolas Sarkozy, president of France from 2007 to 2012, and now a convicted criminal. Late last week, a French court found that Monsieur Sarkozy had encouraged his aides to offer political favours in exchange for money from the former Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi, which went to financing Mr. Sarkozy's election campaign. More serious charges of receiving illegal payments, corruption and personal enrichment were dropped. Needless to say, our Paris correspondent, John Laurenson, has been following the case closely.
J'assumerai mes responsabilités. Je déférerai aux convocations de la justice.
Nicolas Sarkozy, looking a little haggard, but with his singer and former model wife, Carla Bruni, smiling encouragingly by his side, said, minutes after the end of the trial, "I will do what I have to do. I will obey the court summons, and if they are absolutely determined that I sleep in prison, I'll sleep in prison. But with my head held high, I'm innocent. This miscarriage of justice is a scandal." The judge's verdict and sentence were met with jubilation by many of Sarkozy's political opponents on the left, but a number of prominent figures on the right voiced sympathy for him. The Interior Minister Bruno Retailleau, for example, paid homage to Sarkozy, who became president largely because the French people liked his pugilistic style when he was Interior Minister. And many, again on the right, said that following the weighty convictions of ex-right-wing presidential hopeful François Fillon and Rassemblement National leader Marine Le Pen, both for embezzlement, here was another example of what they call la République des juges, literally judges' republic, suggesting that judges and magistrates have too much influence over political life rather than just applying the law. But what exactly has Nicolas Sarkozy been found guilty of? And in what respect, if at all, could this be seen as a miscarriage of justice? Nicolas Bastuc is a specialist in crime and law for the centre-right news magazine Le Point. The court decision was made in accordance with the law, Bastuc said. The crime of criminal conspiracy exists. It was created by our legislators, so you can't blame judges for invoking it. But it is what you might term a chewing gum offence. It'll stick when all the other charges won't, when there's a lack of material proof. And this is what happened here. The definition of criminal conspiracy is a grouping or understanding established in order to prepare a crime. Corruption in this case. There's no need to show that this grouping or understanding had any sort of result, in this case, that any money changed hands, Bastuc said. Critics of this judicial decision are perhaps on firmer ground, though, in criticising the sentence, its length, 5 years, and the fact that the judge stipulated that the sentence should be carried out before the appeals process has come to an end. For some, this judicial stipulation, already used against Marine Le Pen a few months ago, contravenes the principle of innocent until proven guilty. The left-wing investigative website Mediapart has played an important role in this affair. It published a document purporting to show the transfer of money from Libya to the Sarkozy entourage, which was the catalyst for judicial proceedings against Sarkozy, before the judge said that it could not be used as evidence, as it may be a fake. Carla Bruni, approached by a Mediapart journalist after the announcement of the court decision, snatched and threw to the ground the foam from the top of his microphone. That's what the Sarkozys think of Mediapart. And the feeling is mutual. This was what Mediapart reporter Fabrice Arfi replied to those who were claiming the sentence was too severe.
Le jugement nous dit quoi? Nous dit que Nicolas
the judgment states, says Arfi, that Sarkozy and his acolytes negotiated in Tripoli in the autumn of 2005 with the number two of the Gaddafi regime, a terrorist France wanted to arrest called Abdallah Sidoussi, who had the blood of 170 people on his hands, including 54 French nationals, for blowing up an airliner. They went and negotiated with him what the judge called a corruption pact, whose aim was the illegal financing of Nicolas Sarkozy's presidential election campaign. And it doesn't stop there, said Arfi. The judgment states that the trace was found of 6.5 million euros that were transferred with the aim of financing the Sarkozy campaign. There is material evidence of this. Also, that a part of this sum was withdrawn in cash in France during the presidential campaign. The judgment also says that cash circulated illegally in Sarkozy's campaign headquarters and in that of his party, but that it could not be proven for certain that this cash came from Libya. Sarkozy has been summoned to return to court on the 13th of October, when he will find out on what date he will go to prison. He's likely to be incarcerated in the imposing dark brick 19th century jail inside Paris that is called La Santé. The street in front is a pretty one, plane trees, cafes. In a few weeks' time, it'll be possible to sit on a cafe terrace there, sip a beer or possibly a Kia, and think about Nicolas Sarkozy on the other side of that very high wall, and how are the mighty fallen. John Lawrenson, DW, Paris.
Parisian cafe-goers may also ponder that, in France at least, graft is never gratuit. Now, a question for you. What does the gruesome death of an Afghan refugee in Turkey have to do with the plastic waste thrown into dustbins in countries like the UK, France and Germany? As it turns out, everything. But I only know that because I've just binge-listened to all three episodes of Boy Wasted, the new investigative podcast from ENDS Reports and De Groene Amsterdammer. Earlier this week, I sat down for a video call with two of the podcast's reporters, Adnan Khan, a Canadian journalist based between the Netherlands and Turkey, and Tess Coley, ENDS Reports investigations editor. We began very much as the podcast itself begins, with Adnan's story. He's sitting in a plastics recycling factory in Istanbul. It's Sunday, and he's been snuck in by three workers, young men from Afghanistan, who have agreed to tell him about their grim and dangerous existence for a story that he's working on about refugee workers in Turkey's recycling industry. Adnan's taken to bringing a whole roast chicken with him to these meetings. The young men, he thinks, can't be getting enough vitamins.
And at one point, this one third or fourth visit, I was sitting with them, we were eating lunch, and one of them, the youngest, Hayat, he sort of was looking at his phone and looked up and said to me, "Hey, have you heard about Arafula Fuzli?" And I said, "No, who's that?" And he said that he had died in a factory very nearby. And he was scrolling through his phone as he did this, and then he sort of landed on a picture, and then he turned his phone to me. And there was this image, this horrifying sort of image of a mangled body and surrounded by what looked like single-use plastic bags and waste It just kind of took me by surprise. I didn't expect to see such that kind of an image. And I just sort of paused my first question was, what is going on here? Like, what's happening here?
So you had a photograph and crucially, you also had a name. So those were your leads. With those in place, you set about assembling your team. Now, it needed to be an inter-European team because the waste that Arafula had died processing, and I know that's a spoiler, he was in fact an employee at the waste plastics plant. It comes to Turkey from countries like the UK via the Netherlands. So you teamed up with environmental investigative podcast duo Dan Ashby and Lucy Taylor, as well as Tess here and her colleague Pippa Neal from ENDS Report. And actually, I think at this point, I'm going to play a little clip. This is the moment at which the team is first shown the image of Arafula's body.
So I've sent the photo to you on WhatsApp. Would you mind sharing it?
Right, so yeah, a bit of a trigger warning now. It's actually worse than I thought. So I'm just going to share screen. It's pretty horrendous, isn't it?
We'll take a few seconds to take it in.
Oh my God. Christ. That is awful.
So a really confronting beginning. And your role, Tess, it's the British side of the investigation. You're going to help piece together how the rubbish that I might throw away into one of those shiny recycling bins back home in the UK, probably even without thinking about it, how that rubbish connects to Arafullah, the young Afghan refugee lying dead and twisted amongst the trash in that factory in Turkey. Can you help me understand how that connects?
When you throw away your, say, your plastic bottles in a bin in the UK, it starts this whole chain of events that most people, the vast majority would have no idea that happens. So you've got your councils and, you know, they contract out to companies who go and collect the bins, and that gets taken off to processing centres. And then you get a system of waste brokers and all sorts of other third parties who come along and say, well, you know, I can take that off your hands. I can do this. I will take it and I will process it somewhere else. And at that point, things start to get murky. And some of that waste, you know, will be treated legitimately. But a lot of it, I think 20% of the waste, certainly in the UK, is anticipated to have been treated illegally at some point. So that's a huge amount. And then a significant proportion of this waste will end up going out to our ports and eventually from there be exported out to the world. And at that point, our authorities start to basically lose track of where it's going. And they basically admit that to us on the podcast. And the UK is one of the biggest exporters of waste to Turkey. So that's why this story and what happens to Arafullah, that's why this matters to us in the UK and in the rest of Europe.
Tell me how many environmental border agents are checking. Sorry, we're laughing because I know the answer because I've heard the podcast, but it's extraordinary.
It is. So this is one of the biggest shocking findings we had on the UK side. There are about 9 million approximately containers that pass through British ports every year. And there are five environment agency officers in England. Can you even get that around your head? I couldn't. Like, that's extraordinary.
Just describe what we've got around us here. A couple of EA officials ready to do some raids. We're just getting ready.
Yeah, everyone's got their hivers on. Yeah. They're ready to go.
So in theory, this is waste how it's supposed to work. Companies taking our plastic to Turkey to be recycled. I'm intrigued to see what's actually inside. So yeah, let's go.
A warning. It's probably not the dramatic type of enforcement bust you're expecting.
So I'm the port officer for Felixstowe.
This chase involves certificate checks.
This is a paperwork that will accompany all the waste, the green list.
Practical men carefully opening containers.
It's also, I'm using my nose, see what it smells like.
Really? And that most British of crimes.
The stickers don't correspond with the paperwork.
Tess, it's your port inspector who has some of the best lines. He describes the waste industry as a wild west and says that trash is the new narcotics.
Waste is the new narcotics. They're serious organised criminals. They're moving into this sector because for all the reasons we've been discussing, it's a fantastic way to make a bit of money because there's so many gaps to be fallen through. And it's sort of being attached to other like really serious types of crime, like, you know, drugs and guns, and get a bit of waste in there too. That's what we're seeing happen.
And the end result is that, you know, I throw away my wrapper or whatever it is into that shiny bin, don't think anything of it, and assume that it's being recycled. But
Kate, I want to just add in there that, it's interesting how our minds have sort of been sort of conditioned to think of plastic as not just trash. It's been commodified, right? I mean, the reason why we're putting it into these bins is because it's supposedly has this value. Right. So the value that's attached to it, the commodification of plastic, is part of the problem. Right. Because this whole trade is based on this substance that is, for some people, it's what's called negative value. They just want to get rid of it. But for other people on a market, it has a value and different values based on how clean it is, you know, how pure it is. Different materials have different values attached to them. So what we do know is that it's mostly established companies that are involved. And these sort of brokers, these sort of in-between kind of middlemen, that really are the source of the criminal activity. So it's established waste management companies in the UK, in the Netherlands, throughout Europe, that are basically breaking the rules to get rid of the dirty trash that they can't even afford to recycle, because recycling is collapsing in Europe. It's just people aren't able, it's too expensive. People aren't able to sell recycled materials because virgin plastic is still cheaper, or recycled plastic from Turkey is cheaper. So they have to get rid of it somehow. So this is what, yeah, so they're breaking the rules to get rid of it.
The thought that just I can't get out of my head is that, you know, Adnan, you've just said that we're basically in this situation because of the commodification of our trash, right? That it's been given this sort of this nominal value. But Ara Fuller, he's there precisely because of the opposite, because his life has not been given value, right? He is as disposable as the trash that we throw away.
Yeah, I think this is, I mean, at the risk of getting too academic, my wife's an anthropologist, so we talk a lot about this stuff, and especially death, because she's researching death. And, you know, this is what we're seeing, and we're seeing this more broadly in the world, is especially when it comes to migration, is we have a pool of labor, of undocumented labor in the world, the biggest we've ever seen in history, right? And wealthy countries like ours, Canada or European countries, see these bodies as kind of a resource, right? So there's a sort of what anthropologists call a necropolitical component to this, where you have these bodies that are seen as doing as existing in a place where we don't have to think about them. They do something that is benefits our societies, and they're dying doing that, but they're doing it in a quiet shadow somewhere. That in the shadows, we don't have to hear about it. We don't have to feel about it. We don't have to really engage with the consequences of it, right? So I think it's, yeah, this intersection is a really, I think plastic waste and recycling is a window into how our societies are marginalizing the most vulnerable and trying to extract as much value from them that we can.
Tess, whilst we're on the sort of the macro political level, you are just back from the Labour Party conference in the UK, there by invitation, as a direct result of this podcast.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. We've had some like really good responses so far to the podcast, and we got invited by an MP here, Barry Gardner, to go and speak about our findings and about the broader issue of waste crime and recycling, and that was really good to do. You know, one MP described what we'd found is it being about a modern imperialism. Yeah, waste is our biggest export.
The UK's biggest export is rubbish.
Incredible. If you want to talk about national pride, as they have been talking about the Labour conference all weekend, trying to like push back the far right and their claims on English and British identity and national pride, well, maybe a good first step might be to end what we're involved in, basically, abroad.
Okay, but how does this end?
The big question.
Yeah.
The first step is to ban single-use plastics. We need to stop making new plastics. You know, it's just the whole world, most of the world realizes that we just need to reduce plastic quickly. And there's a small piece of that world that's profiting off of virgin plastic and doesn't want to do that. And they're stopping that.
A ban on plastic exports, I think, would be a good step as well, making people realize this is not going away.
Literally, people are dying to clean up your trash.
People like Ara Fuller, the boy wasted, in the podcast of the same name, out now wherever you get your podcasts. My thanks to Adnan Khan and Tess Coley, whose cross-border European journalism was, by the way, made possible with the support of Journalism Fund Europe. More of this, please.
It's post-apocalyptic.
The rest of the body was discovered inside the compactor.
It starts with a boy's body hidden in plastic. Who was the boy? And what really happened to him?
The dark side of an industry worth millions of pounds. And the worst part? It's fueled by the recycling we all throw away.
Boy Wasted, a new 3-part investigation, wherever you get your podcasts.
It's not just Elon Musk. Fascist-era salutes are having a bit of a moment on both sides of the Atlantic. Take Croatia, for example. There, an ultra-nationalist singer opens his most famous song with a World War-era chant that would have been unthinkable not so long ago. And the Prime Minister? Well, he's done his best to try and laugh it off. Guy Delorne reports from the Croatian capital, Zagreb.
Hajduk Split supporters started the new Croatian football season in the most inflammatory fashion. They chanted a Second World War-era fascist salute as they burnt banners bearing the symbols of Serbia. Just to rub in the ultra-nationalist message, they also put on a display celebrating Operation Storm. That military offensive brought Croatia final victory in its war of independence, but it also killed Croatian Serb civilians and made hundreds of thousands of them refugees. Fan behaviour isn't always an accurate reflection of a country as a whole, but in Croatia, it's not just the football ultras who are embracing right-wing nationalism.
Since last year when we had parliamentary elections, we have far-right party in the government. They have also influenced and created a narrative regarding the past, but also regarding to national minorities, for example, special hate for Serbs.
Tena Banjaglav works for Documenta, Centre for Dealing with the Past. She says Prime Minister Andrej Plenković is playing with fire by bringing the ultra-nationalist homeland movement into a coalition with his HDZ party.
He's also taking care of his government because the majority is not really strong. So if homeland movement for any reason decides to leave the government, probably we'll have new elections. This is part of the reason. The other part is that we have a really, really strong corruption everywhere in the state. It's third mandate of this government. He had more than 30 ministers replaced because of really huge corruption affairs. So using ideology and history and all these problems are really trying also to cover or to mask some of the corruption affair and other problems in the state.
And history is very much part of Croatia's present. This was the sound of the crowd getting itself in the mood ahead of Croatia's biggest ever concert. They were there to see Marko Perković, who uses the stage name Thompson after the brand of gun that he used during the War of Independence. His management claimed they sold more than 500,000 tickets for July's mega gig at Zagreb's Hippodrome. That's a startling statistic for an act who's been banned in multiple countries for his alleged Nazi sympathies. Indeed, Thompson's best-known song, Chavoglave Battalion, opens with the same fascist salute favoured by football ultras. But Croatia's Prime Minister Andrej Plenković didn't see that as a problem.
The left-wing opposition and media are not happy that 500,000 people came to this concert and that everything went peacefully, that it was nice that young people came in an atmosphere of unity. If something is part of the song, obviously no one will censor or change the song.
But in fact, it's not just left-wing groups who have a problem with Thompson's use of the phrase Zadom Spremni. It means for homeland ready, and it was the call-and-response salute of the Nazi-allied Croat nationalist Ustasha movement during the Second World War. Croatia's highest court has ruled its use unconstitutional, and the European Court of Human Rights has backed that judgment. That explains why rights groups were alarmed when the Prime Minister posed for a pre-performance picture with Thompson and outraged when governing party MPs joined in the chants.
Our organisation called this the biggest pro-fascist gathering in Europe since World War II, as we would call an event where 500,000 people would gather in Germany or Austria and yell Sieg Heil or Heil Hitler.
Mario Mazic is the director in Croatia of the Youth Initiative for Human Rights, a regional organisation that promotes inter-ethnic reconciliation.
Having in mind that Croatia is a EU member state, by definition it should sort of serve as an example for the rest of the region. But when you're looking at Croatia today, you see a country that did not deal with its World War II past, and is even in a way siding with the losing side. You see a country that when it comes to the 90s still did not recognize that it waged an unjust war in Bosnia, and you see a country that refuses to acknowledge the systematic nature of crimes within Croatia against the Serbs.
The big Tomsten show in Zagreb wasn't the singer's only massive concert over the summer. There was another last month in the Dalmatian town of Sinj, and it formed part of the celebrations of the 30th anniversary of Operation Storm. Tomsten supporters say his repertoire should be judged in that context, fascist salute and all.
It was an authentic outcry for the freedom and against the aggression.
Matthias Strahan is a conservative commentator.
Many journalists in the West say that it is a Croatian version of Heil Hitler. I think it would be best described as Croatian version of Slava Ukraini. They both rose to prominence in the context of World War II. And just like Slava Ukraini today does not mean the same thing as in World War II, So Zadom Spremni also means something different.
But there's no altering the unsavory history of Zadom Spremni. It was coined by the murderous Ustasha, then revived in the 90s by an extreme right-wing militia called the Croatian Defence Forces. They flaunted their fascist credentials, even naming their units after Ustasha generals. But now, the government seems keen to rehabilitate the chant, and historian Tvertko Jakovina is appalled but unsurprised.
All these things became more visible since UK left the European Union, because when it comes to anti-fascist values, it cannot be only up to Germany to protect them in the context of the European Union. Plenković is not Orban. For as long as you do not bother in the way as Orban bothers anyone in Brussels, no one pays attention. And this is how it is.
It seems a long time since this fascist salute prompted official outrage in Croatia. Footballer Josip Simonic had the book well and truly thrown at him for this post-match outburst in 2013. Judges convicted him of spreading racial hatred. Today, Prime Minister Plenković says Thompson's use of Zadom Spremni is just part of his repertoire. That's an unwelcome reminder that Croatia still has to reckon with its past before it can truly move into the future. Guy Delaunay, DW, Zagreb.
We're nearly at the end of the show. Just time for this. England have won the Women's Rugby World Cup, beating Canada 33-13 at Twickenham. What I want to know is, what are the players known as? Are they the Lionesses, the Red Roses, or the Albionistas? Head over to Spotify if you think you know the answer. Just before we go, if you would like to vote for Inside Europe in the 2025 Signal Podcast Awards, we will be putting a link in the show notes. Our Grief, a Catalyst for Social Change special is up for an award, and we would really appreciate your votes. That's it for this week. Our show was produced by Laura Kabelka and me, Kate Laycock. Our sound engineer was Jürgen Kuhn. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.